Today I want to begin in Deuteronomy chapter 11. That's pretty much where we left off last time concerning our studies. Actually, a study we're going to do of the seven changes between the Old and the New Covenant. However, it's important that we set some background and see what the Old Testament laws did, what their purposes were, and what changes were made by the event of the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. Deuteronomy chapter 11 is a list of blessings that are essentially physical in nature. New Testament contains spiritual promises that are better in nature. So if we are going to understand why they are better, first let's look at the ones that they are better than. Chapter 11, verse 1 of Deuteronomy, "Therefore you shall love the Lord your God and keep his charge, his statutes, his judgments, and his commandments always." So these same four things that Abraham kept: his charge, what we are to do, his statutes, specific laws, of which there are about 220, his judgments, and his commandments, the Ten Commandments upon which they are all built. "Know today that I do not speak with your children who have not known and have not who have not seen the chastening of the Lord your God, his greatness and his mighty hand and his outstretched arm, his signs and his acts, which he did in the midst of Egypt, to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and to all this land." So he's talking to these people who survived in the wilderness 40 years. Some commentaries say the oldest person in this group, when they were getting ready to cross into the promised land, was either 59 or 60 years old. Except for, of course, Joshua and Caleb. Verse 4, "And what he did to the army of Egypt, to their horses, their chariots, how he made the waters of the Red Sea overflow them as they pursued you, and how the Lord has destroyed them to this day. And what he did for you in the wilderness until you came into this place. What he did to Dathan and Abiram and the sons of Eliab, the son of Reuben. How the earth opened up its mouth and swallowed up their households, their tents, and all their substance that was in their possession in the midst of Israel. But your eyes have seen every great act of the Lord which he did." And that would be true of all of those who are between age 40 and 60. "Therefore you shall keep every commandment which I command you today, that you may be strong and go in to possess the land when you cross over." Now the purpose of this promise and this set of laws was that this was going to be their governing documents when they crossed into the promised land. Says that you may prolong your days in the land which the Lord swore to give your fathers, to them and their descendants, a land flowing with milk and honey. For the land which you go to possess is not like the land of Egypt which you have come, where you sowed your seed and watered it by foot as a vegetable garden. Now, the land of Egypt is dependent upon the Nile River. It does not receive enough rain to grow crops. All of the vegetation essentially has to be irrigated from the Nile River. If you've been to Egypt, you've seen it. We were able to go there last year and then go up in a hot air balloon ride there at Luxor. It's amazing just how beautifully green the Nile Valley is. It's just absolutely lush with sugar cane and vegetables of all kinds. And it is all irrigated from the Nile River. But the land of Palestine to which they were going, the promised land, was a land that they depended not upon the river, but they were dependent upon God for rain, the early rain and the latter rain. So he says, "The land which you cross over to possess is a land of hills and valleys, which drinks water from the rain of heaven." So instead of having a covenant or being dependent upon the Nile River, in this case, they were going to be dependent upon God to send them rain in due season. Verse 12, "A land for which the Lord your God cares. The eyes of the Lord your God are always on it, from the beginning of the year to the very end of the year." Probably still true today. God's eyes are always on that land, and certainly what he sees happening over there now must be very frustrating, because it certainly is for all of us who watch the news and see those events and the terrible suffering in that land, terrible contentions. But God cares for that land. His eyes are on it from the beginning of the year to the very end of the year. "And it shall be that if you earnestly obey my commandments, which I command you today, to love the Lord your God, to serve him with all your heart and with all your soul, then I will give you the rain for your land in its season, the early rain and the latter rain, that you may gather in your grain, your new wine, and your oil." So God promises if they would obey him, He would give them rain in due season, good crops. I will send grass in your fields for your livestock, that you may eat and be filled. But take heed to yourselves, lest your heart be deceived, and you turn aside and serve other gods and worship them, lest the Lord's anger be aroused against you, and he shut up the heavens, so there yet be no rain, and the land yield no produce, and you quickly perish from the good land which the Lord is giving you. So he warned them not to be complacent in their blessings, not to let the good times destroy their attitude, but we see in their history that it pretty much always did. It took 20 years in the times of Solomon. Some of the cycles in the book of Judges were more like 40 years. Therefore you shall lay up these words of mine in your heart and in your soul and bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes. So as frontlets, so they're not the same thing as the thing with the tassels. They're to be as, not be there specifically. You shall teach them to your children, speaking of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you rise up. And you shall write them on the doorposts of your house and your gates, that your days and the days of your children may be multiplied in the land of your fathers, which the Lord God swore to give to your fathers, like the days of the heavens of the earth. So here we have God promising them crops, prosperity. He says in verse 22, if you carefully keep these commandments, which I command you, to love the Lord your God, to walk in all his ways, and to hold fast to him, then the Lord will drive out all these nations from before you, and you will dispossess greater and mightier nations than you. And he mentions here, every place on which the sole of your foot treads shall be yours. And in verse 25, no one will be able to stand against you. So he promises protection from foreign nations attacking them, protection from threats from the outside. Then we have down in verse 29, it shall be when the Lord your God has brought you into the land which you go to possess, that you shall put the blessing on Mount Gerizim and the curse on Mount Ebal. Now we'll read later that they were actually to be divided in half, six tribes on Mount Ebal, six tribes on Mount Gerizim, and they were literally to read Deuteronomy 28 and yell the blessings and cursings back and forth across the valley in between. Now, down in that valley is located a little place called Shechem. It's where Joseph was buried, and it was where Jacob's well is. And sadly, today is very, very difficult to visit because it's part of the what they call the Palestinian territories, and it's difficult to get in there as an American to visit. But when I was there in 1974 on the dig, we spent much of a day there and one Sabbath. It was a very rewarding and inspiring place to be. But it just mentions here, to be verse 32, be careful to observe all the statutes and judgments which I set before you. Now, verse 32 introduces chapter 12, because chapter 12 begins 15 chapters of what you might call the laws of Israel when they come into the promised land. This section of scripture lasts 15 chapters and tells them how they were to live. It is to be the law of the land. There were no additional laws authorized to be made. They simply were to live by these 15 chapters. If we had more of a dedication to live according to these chapters in our land, we wouldn't have the hundreds of thousands of laws that have been added unto them, certainly not nearly as many. This might be called how to obey God in their new home. Each one of these laws that is given in these 15 chapters is an extension of one of the Ten Commandments. It is how to apply the Ten Commandments in principle when you live in the land that I'm giving to you. Chapter 12 and verse 1, these are the statutes and the judgments which you shall be careful to observe in the land which the Lord your God of your fathers is giving you to possess all the days you live on the earth. So the first law they were to live by was to get rid of the idols. You shall utterly destroy all the places where the nations which you go to dispossess serve their gods, on the high mountains and on the hills, under every green tree. You shall destroy their altars, break their sacred pillars, burn their wooden images with fire, and you shall cut down the carved images of their gods and destroy their names from that place. They sadly didn't do this completely. Well, they were men, they were kings like Hezekiah and others who made a pretty good effort, but there were still high places. They did not finish the job and completely destroy idolatry from the land. Verse 4 is an interesting sidelight to the second commandment. You shall not worship the Lord your God with such things. So it's very easy to understand that we don't adopt pagan religious ideas, symbols, rituals, or even phrases to worship the true God. We just don't. It's wrong. God forbids it. We don't worship the Lord our God with such things, even though there are many who try to make an excuse, say, well, it's okay if we use, you know, these symbols, you know, these pieces of wood or this whatever it might be, or this holiday or this whatever term it might be. You know, they have lots of human excuses. I'm sure so you've heard those. But very clearly, you shall not learn from the pagans. You shall not worship the Lord your God with such things. But you shall seek the place where the Lord your God chooses out of all your tribes to put his name for his dwelling place for you to be there. Now, the first place where they set up the tabernacle when they crossed into the promised land was a place called Shiloh. It is still there today. You can go visit it. It's pretty much just a farmer's pasture with a bunch of rocks out there. But if you go visit Shiloh, there is a ramp made out of stones that comes up about 3 feet high. It's about, I'm going to guess, about 14 to 16 feet long. And I've seen it. It's the ramp that was used for the priest to come up to the altar and give their sacrifices way back in the time of Joshua. So it's a very important piece of archaeological history. If you look in some of the archaeological magazines about Shiloh, no doubt you would find some pictures. But it was unearthed in the early 1970s, and it is a very important piece of biblical history. But they were to come where God would place his name, and the first one was Shiloh, later it was at Bethel, and then finally, of course, in Jerusalem. But he says here in verse 6, there you shall take your burnt offerings, your sacrifices, tithes, heave offerings of your hand, vowed offerings and freewill offerings, and the firstborn of your herds and flocks. So this was to give everyone instructions on where they were to take their sacrifices once God's dwelling place had been set up. So we have here the interesting, you might say, application. Verse 7, you shall eat before the Lord your God. You shall rejoice in all that you put your hand to do in your households in which the Lord your God has blessed you. You shall not do at all as we are doing here today, with every man doing whatever is right in his own eyes. So Moses was concerned as he saw this new generation of Israelites that they were starting to become, let's just say, very strong-minded of their own self, every man doing what is right in their own eyes. And he said, this is going to have to stop. For as yet you have not come to the rest and the inheritance which the Lord your God is giving you. He said, you haven't gone over the Jordan yet. We're not there in the rest yet. There's much work to do. But I think this verse that tells us every man was doing what was right in his own eyes tells us why later in Joshua we find that seven of the tribes did not complete their assigned conquering of the promised land. And they left Hittites and Amorites and others there in the land when they should have gotten rid of them. And of course, those idolatrous nations came back as a curse to them. But this tells you right up front that there were some character issues, some character degeneration that was already going on among these people who had come out of Egypt and had spent 40 years in the wilderness. Verse 10, when you cross over the Jordan and dwell in the land which the Lord your God is giving you to inherit, and he gives you rest from all your enemies round about so that you dwell in safely, there you shall be in the place where the Lord your God chooses to make his name abide. And there you shall bring all that I command. Again, they should bring their offerings and all of those things they would give on the holy days and other times to the place where God chooses. And of course, there are some descriptions here of clean and unclean meats, what they could offer, what they could not offer. Verse 17 mentions tithing. You may not eat within your gates the tithe of your grain or your new wine or your oil, or the firstborn of your herd, of your flock, any of your offerings which you vow, your freewill offerings, or the heave offering. You must eat them before the Lord your God in the place where the Lord your God chooses, you and your son, your daughters, male servants, and of course, you know, the rest of the household. So they understood, at least they were beginning to understand, that the laws of God applied to their everyday lives. If we were to draw a diagram of the laws of God, it would be in the shape of a pyramid. And the very top piece, the cornerstone, would be love, because God is love. And then the two great commandments below that would be love to our fellow man. And of course, the first one, love to God with all of our heart and all of our mind and all of our being. Jesus Christ said, on these two great commandments hang the other 10. So then the other 10 then are below those. So you have half of them that are part of the first great commandment, half of them that are part of the second. Some say it's 4 and 6, but honestly, the principle applies to both. Below those 10 commandments, if you have God as love, and then the two great commandments and the 10 commandments below them, each one a way to obey the earlier commandments, there are 226 statutes beneath each one of those. So the pyramid gets very wide on that fourth level. The statutes are simply further explanations of how to obey each one of those commandments. And every one of them can be tied back to one of the 10 commandments. One of the best examples is tithing. Tithing is putting God first in your life. Honor God first with the first fruits of all of your produce. That's how you have no other gods before Him. One of the things we just read about destroying idols and the sacred pillars is an example of keeping the second commandment. You shall have no idols. So each one of these 226 statutes fits neatly under one of the commandments. The third layer would be what's called judgments. Judgments are how the commandments of God and the laws of God apply to everyday life. Good examples in the Bible, and there are many. There are a couple hundred of them, but they, like, if your cow destroys your fence and then goes over and does some damage on your neighbor's property, how can you apply that, or how can justice be made? There are also judgments for those that break the seventh commandment, for those who commit murder. The judgments are how to apply in everyday life, and they were to be the guidelines for how the nation should operate when they were in the promised land. Now, the judgments are limitless. There is no finite number of them. Because honestly, we make judgments every day, and we need to make those judgments based on either a principle or a specific example in the Bible, in the laws of God. Sadly, people often can deceive themselves, convince themselves that they don't have to obey or go by what God says, and of course, we have very, very serious consequences of that. A human mind can be very deceitful, and we have to be very, very careful of that. Now, Deuteronomy 12 through 26, these 15 chapters, details how they are to obey God once they're in the promised land. Let's go to chapter 14. You're all very familiar with chapter 14 because it is two very important subjects. First is tithing. Verse 22, you shall truly tithe all the increase of the grain of your field. Actually, that's second. First is the unclean food. Verse 2, you are a holy people to the Lord your God. The Lord has chosen you to be a special people for himself, a special treasure above all the peoples who are on the face of the earth. You shall not eat any detestable thing. Now, Satan is happy when we eat detestable things. I saw a news article last night about snakes. They're trying to raise cobras over in India, I think it is, because cobras multiply and they don't have a carbon footprint. I never heard of a carbon footprint on an animal that doesn't have feet, but that's, you know, what they said. And there's all sorts of ways that the land around us is, or the people in the world, are constantly being deceived into thinking they should eat things they don't eat. There was a special on NPR this week about the declining population of iguanas in Nicaragua, because Nicaraguans love to eat iguanas. And certain things in life just make you sick thinking about them, but that's one of them. And they call it the other white meat down in Nicaragua. So at any rate, as God says, you shall not eat any detestable thing. Very important that we understand that we don't eat any detestable thing. These are the animals which you may eat, and we are all very familiar with this list of animals. Verse 23, after tithing is introduced, says, you shall eat before the Lord your God in the place where he chooses to make your name, his name abide, the tithe of your grain, your new wine, your oil, the firstborn of your herds and your flocks, that you may learn to fear your God always. So this is second tithe. This is the year of that tithe, the tithe that is for the feast, which we keep every year, of course. And then the third tithe is introduced in verse 28. At the end of every third year, you shall bring about the tithe of your produce. So here we have very important principles about how to apply the first commandment in our lives. Also down in chapter 15, we have at the end of every 7 years, you shall grant a release of debts. They were not to be enslaved in debt that was overbearing. If they were going to borrow money or mortgage their property, they had to either base it on the 7 years when the next land Sabbath was, or finally the year of Jubilee. It would be a wonderful thing if our nation had kept that promise and kept those laws. We would not now have foreigners buying up vast amounts of our farmland, or the super rich buying up more land than the size of some states, but that's essentially where we are. But chapter 15 is about the year of release. And also, verse 7, if there is among you a poor man and your brethren with any of the gates in your land which the Lord your God is giving you, you shall not harden your heart nor shut your hand from your poor brother. You shall open your hand wide to him and willfully lend him sufficient for his need, whatever he needs. And then he mentions a warning about having a wicked thought in your heart. Verse 10, you shall surely give to him, and your heart should not be grieved when you give to him. So an example of the second commandment, love God, or love your fellow man as yourself. Now let's go to chapter 16, which concerns, again, the Passover. God reminds them, chapter 16 and verse 1, observe the month of Abib, keep the Passover of the Lord your God. So they were to sacrifice the Passover and keep it, and keep unleavened bread when they were in the area of the promised land. And some of the other holy days are also mentioned here. Verse 12 says, you shall remember that you were a slave in Egypt. So when you have prosperity, when you have freedom, when you have rain in due season, don't forget that you were at one time a slave. And of course, very famous verse that we read often on the holy days, verse 16, three times a year all your males shall appear before God and give an offering. Now chapter 16, verse 19 says, you shall not pervert justice, nor show partiality, nor take a bribe. We have so much of that going on in our land today that our legal system is almost dysfunctional on most levels. It is truly a sad epitaph. As if you look back in history, when Octavian said essentially he had to defeat Mark Antony and take over the Roman Empire, it was because the legal system had completely become corrupt. And people were being bought off, judges were, and of course it was a very serious situation. It was a sort of a last flag in the air signaling the end of an empire that had lasted four centuries. I'm sorry, of a republic that had lasted four centuries. Now let's drop on down to chapter 17. Chapter 17 says, justice shall be administered by the Levites. And of course, any accusation had to be had to have two witnesses, had to be verified by two people. No one could be convicted. No one could be even tried, essentially, with only one witness of the crime. Boy, if that was carried out today, we would have a much different society. Think of all the people who have been smeared by false accusations of one person. And certainly they use this now very often in political circles. And it just says here that the Levites should be the ones. Verse 9, you shall come to the priests, the Levites, to the judge there in those days, and inquire of them, and they shall pronounce upon you the sentence of judgment. Verse 10, you shall do according to the sentence in which they pronounce upon you in that place, which the Lord chooses. And you shall be careful to do all that they order you to do. So there was to be a respect of the Levites and the judges, and they were to make decisions based on character, based on what is right, and based on the pure evidence, not any bribes or any preconceived ideas. Now then, chapter 18 concerns the cities. The Levites, the priests, shall have no part of inheritance, but they would have Levitical cities, and a number of those would be then cities of refuge for those who were accused. And if they were guilty or not, they would then come to a trial, and that would be determined. Now then we have chapter 20 and verse 1. When you go out to battle, this section concerns God's protection in battle. And there are some phrases here that are very similar to what the Apostle Paul instructed the New Testament church concerning our spiritual battles, that we are to go to battle in faith and not be afraid of the adversaries. Chapter 20 and verse 1, when you go out to battle against your enemies, and you see their horses and their chariots and people more numerous than you, do not be afraid of them. You know, the New Testament concerns us, tells us so many times not to be afraid, but to have faith that our God will be with us. It says, for the Lord your God is with you, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. And so it shall be when you are on the verge of battle that the priest shall approach and speak to the people. Notice it wasn't the commander of the army. It wasn't the king who was to approach the people. It was the priest who was to approach the people. And he would say to them, "Hear, O Israel, today you are on the verge of battle with your enemies. Don't let your heart faint. Don't be afraid. Don't tremble or be afraid of them. For the Lord your God is he who goes with you to fight for you against your enemies and to save you." Reminds me of Romans 16 that says, God will soon crush Satan under your feet. One of the most wonderful ends to a book I've ever heard of. So God will crush Satan under our feet. We are in a spiritual battle, but we have to have this type of faith that God's going to be with us and see us through. Verse 5, the officer shall speak to the people, saying, "What man?" Of course, they would then cut down the number of the army. But the important thing here is that the priest was to tell them not to be afraid, not to be terrified, because God would give them the victory. There are many parallels with the new covenant because we are in a spiritual warfare, and Peter and Paul taught the same thing in several places. Now let's go over to chapter 22. Chapter 21 concerns trials for murder. Chapter 22, these are miscellaneous laws concerning the seventh commandment, "Thou shalt not commit adultery." This chapter has rules and laws that protect the family. When they came into the promised land, God knew that the cornerstone building block of society was a man and his wife and their children, and them being loyal and obedient and to God, loyal to each other, and working together to build the nation. Now, that sadly has been falling by the wayside. Now, this great nation we live in was built by families. Now they have listened to Satan's message for so long that the family structure itself is simply falling apart. But chapter 22, these laws concerning the seventh commandment. First, of course, it starts out with, if your neighbor's donkey goes astray, you give it back to him. A little bit farther down, verse 13, if a man takes a wife and goes into her and detests her and charges her with shameful conduct, there is a test that goes on. I don't know if that ever actually happened or not, no record of that. But certainly it is one of these places, plus Leviticus 18, that protect the family and protect the family structure that God set up. Then down in verse chapter 23, again, we have miscellaneous laws concerning divorce, miscellaneous laws concerning the family and property. Verse 6 of chapter 23, on the subject of foreign nations, he says, "You shall not seek their peace nor their prosperity all your days forever." So he simply says, you are to be a good example to other nations, and when they see that you have these great laws, as it mentions in the book of Deuteronomy here, they would come back and they would say, "Tell us about your God and the great laws that you follow, because we see you are being blessed so much. We have spent billions and billions of dollars, and who knows how many man hours, seeking the prosperity of other nations who have, of course, in most cases, not benefited from that. And the one nation on earth that has received more foreign aid and more American money than any nation on earth per capita is the nation of Haiti. And Haiti today is in a degenerate situation where the streets are run by criminals, and simply there's a lot of destruction, violence, and the president of the country had to flee. So a lot of this foreign money has simply been squandered. If we had read this verse and understood what it meant, that we should be a righteous nation, Israel was given a commission to be a righteous nation, a beacon of light for the rest of the world, and teach other people to keep God's laws, but we have forgotten all about that. Now, chapter 24 simply concerns some of the more family issues and the offering of first fruits. And it ends over in chapter 26 then, and talk about verse 26 and verse 1. "It shall be when you come into the land which the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance, and you dwell it. You shall take some of the produce of the ground which you shall bring from the land that the Lord your God is giving you, and put it in a basket, and go to the Lord your God," and basically thank him. To give God a big thank offering for what he had done to them. Now, verse 18, I'm sorry, verse 17. Deuteronomy 26, verses 17, 18, and 19 are the summary of these 15 chapters of law. They began with the final verse in Deuteronomy 14, and these laws here, or this section here, is the final summary of these laws. Today you have proclaimed that the Lord to be your God, that you will walk in his ways, keep his statutes and commandments and his judgments, that you will obey his voice. They promised they would obey his voice. Today the Lord has proclaimed you to be his special people, just as he promised you, that you should keep all his commandments, that he will set you high above all nations, which he has made in praise, in name, and in honor, and that you may be a holy people to the Lord your God, just as he has spoken. So this section, these 15 chapters, are very important to understand, because this was rolled up in a scroll and written down by Moses, and written down to make sure that the people understood that it was not to be forgotten. You see, back over, let's go over to, let me see, just for the sake of time, let's go over to chapter 32. Chapter 32. Well, wait a minute, hold on a second, I forgot something that happens sometimes. Chapter 27, verse 1. Moses and the elders of Israel commanded the people, saying, keep all the commandments which I command you today, and it shall be on the day when you cross over the Jordan to the land which the Lord your God is giving you, that you shall set up for yourselves large stones and whitewash them with lime. So when they crossed over, after Moses was dead, there was a period of mourning for Moses, and then God had them cross over during the days of unleavened bread, right as they began. And they were to set up a large monument with stones that were to be whitewashed. You shall write on them all the words of this law, when you have crossed over, that you may enter the land which the Lord your God is giving you, a land flowing with milk and honey, just as the Lord your God of your fathers has promised. Now these stones had all of this law, all of these 16 chapters written in them, perhaps even going back to Deuteronomy, the first 12 chapters, especially the chapter 5 with the Ten Commandments. But when Paul in 2 Corinthians 3 references the law of administration or the law of death written in stones, this is the example. These are the stones where all this law was written. When Paul talks about the law written in stones or the law of death and life, it was not the Ten Commandments, because there was no death sentence in the Ten Commandments. It was in these stones that this law was written. First place, it took a lot of stones. You cannot write this many chapters unless it was a pretty good sized pile of stones, and it was whitewashed so that the inscriptions as they wrote in the stones could be much easier to read. So when you read 2 Corinthians 3, keep that in mind, that these stones upon the administration of death where they were written, these are the stones he was talking about. And notice this, we shall be, verse 5, there you shall build an altar to the Lord your God, an altar of stones, and you shall not use an iron tool on them, you shall build with whole stones. So they had to be round stones that could be stacked together. It says, you shall offer burnt offerings on it to the Lord, you shall offer peace offerings, and shall eat there and rejoice before the Lord your God. And you shall write very plainly on these stones all the words of this law. And this law did contain the death penalty for certain crimes, certain capital crimes. Then Moses and the priests and the Levites spoke to all Israel, saying, take heed and listen to Israel. This day you have become the people of the Lord your God. They agreed to it. They agreed to it with Moses. They agreed with Joshua there. Everybody promised everybody that we would obey God, and they would obey all of these laws that were given. Verse 10, therefore you shall obey the voice of the Lord your God and observe his commandments and his statutes, which I command you today. And Moses commanded the people on the same day, saying, there shall stand on Mount Gerizim to bless the people when you have crossed over the Jordan. He lists six of the 12 tribes, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Joseph, and Benjamin. These would stand on Mount Gerizim, and they would read the blessings to the people. And it says, these shall stand on Mount Ebal to curse Reuben, Gad, Asher, Zebulun, Dan, and Naphtali. Now, the mountains are fairly short. They may be 2,000 feet high. They're not large. They're not Mount Hood and Mount St. Helens. They're just two fairly small, what we would call large hills, but over there they called them mountains. And there would be enough for these tribes to divide up, and then they would read the blessings from Mount Gerizim and the curses from Mount Ebal. Now you can easily remember that because Ebal sounds like evil. So they read the curses or the evil things from Mount Ebal. And those guys, by the way, had the larger assignment because the section in Deuteronomy 28 concerning the curses is much longer than the section concerning the blessings. And they would then say, "A Levite shall speak with a loud voice and say to all the men of Israel, cursed is the one who makes a carved or molded image, an abomination to the Lord, the work of the hands of craftsmen, and sets it up in secret." And all people would say, "Amen." So they would talk about all these curses. They would say, "Cursed is a person who does that." Everybody would say, "Amen." A couple years at summer camp, I tried to find two hills somewhere around Rockaway Beach, so I could have half the campers on one hill and half on the other and read the blessings and cursings. But essentially, it's a flat beach, and other than one hill that they escaped to for tsunamis, there wasn't an opportunity to do that. So we never did, but I think it would have been fun for the campers if we'd had that chance. Now let's go over, now he gets into the next chapter, by the way, you're very familiar with, 28. That's the blessings and cursings beginning. But let's go over to chapter 32. Chapter 32, which is a song of Moses. Now in Revelation, it talks about the saints singing the song of Moses. Many people assume that that is the song that Miriam and the sister of Moses and others sang as they had tambourines. They came down the hill on the last day of unleavened bread after they had successfully crossed the Red Sea, that God had opened the door for them. They came across the Red Sea. The Egyptians were all drowned in the sea, and they sang this dance. A wonderful song, by the way. It's nothing wrong with it at all. But that may be possibly the song of Moses that is going to be sung as pictured in Revelation. The other option is this one. God doesn't tell us in Revelation, you know, same song, second verse, doesn't tell us the title of the song. He just tells us the song of Moses, and either one of these would qualify. So verse 30 of chapter 31 says, "Moses spoke in the hearing of all the assembly of Israel the words of this song until they were ended. Give ear, O heavens, I will speak, hear, earth, O the words of my mouth, the teaching drips like rain." And of course, you know most of what it says here. Verse 7, "Remember the days of old, consider the many years of generations." He goes back to the time of creation. Verse 8, "When the Most High divided their inheritance among the nations, when he separated the sons of Adam, he set the boundaries of the peoples according to the number of the children of Israel." Interesting that Moses said that the national boundaries were established at the time, basically, of Adam. He set the boundaries according to what would be needed by the people of Israel. We don't understand all the details, but someday it will be fun to finally find it out. "For the Lord's portion is his people, Jacob is the place of his inheritance." Now this entire song of Moses grows eerily prophetic. Verse 15, "Israel," or Jeshurun as he's called here, "grew fat and kicked. You grew fat, you grew thick, you are obese." I don't know if he's talking about the land in which we live today, in which obesity is rampant, or certainly it's true in many of the Israelitish nations, but perhaps worse here. "He forsook God who made him and scornfully esteemed the rock of his salvation." That is so true with government, with what is going on in our country. Many people scornfully hate, scornfully look down on the rock of our salvation. And Mr. Reeves was telling me that when the new Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson? Yeah, when he went up to the Speaker's podium, he carried his Bible with him. And there were people that were booing him and making all sorts of catcalls because he carried his Bible up with him and actually proclaimed in public he believed in the Bible. I cannot imagine that happening during the time of, let's say, John Adams, John Quincy Adams, or even many presidents since then, but that's the times in which we live. Our elected leaders scornfully hate or despise their rock of salvation. Verse 18, "Of the rock who begot you, you are unmindful, you have forgotten the God who fathered you." And as you continue on down, he gets into not only the things that would happen to Israel, the things that they would go into captivity and they would be punished, but he even has some sort of you might say, end time prophecies or end time things that are said there. Verse 39, now see that I, even I, am he, and there is no God besides me. So God now is saying it, not Moses. I kill, I make alive, I wound and I heal, nor is there any who can deliver from my hand. I raise my hand to heaven, and I say, as I live forever, if I wet my glittering sword and my hand takes hold on judgment, I will render vengeance on my enemies. That clearly happens in Revelation chapter 18 and some of the earlier chapters with all the seven last plagues and the other plagues, the trumpet plagues, things that happen. So I'll render vengeance to my enemies. This song of Moses covers thousands of years of history. I'll repay those who hate me. I will make my arrows drunk with blood. My sword shall devour flesh with the blood of the slain and the captives from the heads of the leaders of the enemy. Then verse 43 is about the millennium. Rejoice, O Gentiles, with his people. When do the Gentiles rejoice with the people of God? It is in the millennium, after they are led back. And there are prophecies in Isaiah and Jeremiah, Ezekiel about roads being built and people migrating and the people of Egypt keeping the Feast of Tabernacles. So rejoice, O Gentiles, with his people happens after Jesus Christ returns. He will avenge the blood of his servants and render vengeance to his adversaries. He'll provide atonement for his land and his people. So this song of Moses is one that is prophetic and goes quite a long way in telling us what's going to happen in the future. And it's supposed to be memorized by the people of Israel, but sadly they have forgotten it. Well, the next thing that happened is covered for us over in Joshua. Let's go to Joshua chapter 18. Joshua chapter 18. This is after Joshua has spent several years conquering the promised land. God gave them victory after victory after victory. They learned some hard lessons the first time they attacked Ai, and certainly they learned to trust God after that and do things the way God said to. There are interesting analyses done by some authors about the battles in the Bible, and these battles of Joshua are a big part of those books. But in chapter 18 and verse 1, the whole congregation of the children of Israel assembled together in Shiloh and set up the tabernacle of meeting there, and the land was subdued before them. So basically, Joshua's wars are over. They are now setting up the tabernacle for the first time in the promised land, and it is set up at Shiloh. But verse 2, there remained among the children of Israel seven tribes which had not yet received their inheritance. Maybe their men had been fighting along with the other tribes. Maybe they had conquered enough of the land for the leaders to have, you know, houses and farms. But they did not finish the job. Then Joshua said to the children of Israel, how long will you neglect to go and possess the land which the Lord your God, your fathers, has given you? And so he said, why are you waiting? Why are you being so patient? Why not go and do what God said to do, to conquer the promised land? Quite a number of New Testament parallels with those who neglect salvation, not knowing that the time is short, with those who get sidelined. Jesus Christ talked about the weeds coming up and choking. So Joshua admonished them, you had better finish the job God gave you to do. And it should be, of course, something that each one of us is determined that we're going to do the right way. The sin of partial obedience, of partially obeying God and saying that's good enough, is never going to end up in that person being in the promised land or being in God's kingdom forever. Sadly, what happened here is a cycle then of sin, punishment, regret, restoration, and then sin, punishment, regret, and more restoration. Let's go over to Joshua chapter 24. Joshua chapter 24. In this chapter, which is right towards the end of Joshua, obviously it's the last one, Joshua had his final talk with these Israelites, admonishing them because they hadn't finished their job yet, but he made them promise, recovenant with God, that they would obey him. Joshua chapter 24, let's begin in verse 14. Now therefore, fear the Lord, serve him in sincerity and truth. Put away the gods which your father served on the other side of the river. So the first step was to put away idols. Serve the Lord. If it seems evil to you to serve the Lord, choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve, whether the gods which were on the other side of the river, or the gods of the Amorites, or in the land in which you dwell, but as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. So the people answered. They listened to what Joshua said, and they said, far be it from us that we should forsake the Lord to serve other gods. Sadly, that commitment wasn't held on to for very long. Let's continue on down. Now, the oldest person here, by the way, as we mentioned, might have been 59 or 60, so it wasn't all that long. Verse 18, the Lord drove out from before us all the people, including the Amorites who dwelt in the land. We will serve the Lord, for he is our God. Now, Joshua knew they were not 100% committed. Joshua said to the people, you cannot serve the Lord, for he's a holy God. He's a jealous God. He will not forgive your transgressions or your sins. If you forsake the Lord and serve foreign gods, then he will turn and do you harm and consume you after he has done this to you. And so the people argued with Joshua. No, but we'll serve. We will serve the Lord. And Joshua said to the people, you are witnesses against yourselves that you have chosen the Lord for yourselves to serve him. And they said, we are witnesses. You know, yes, we promise over and over and over, you know, 1,000 times over. Now, therefore, he said, put away the foreign gods which are among you and incline your heart to the Lord God of Israel. And the people said to Joshua, the Lord our God we will serve, and his voice we will obey. Actually, four times, but three times very specifically. They promised they would not serve the idols of the land, but they would serve God all the days of their life in the land. Verse 31 says, Israel served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua and had known all the works of the Lord which he had done for Israel. And that's sort of the end of the story of Joshua. Joshua's generation stayed loyal to God, and God gave them promises, and God gave them the blessings that they needed. But back in verse 26, Joshua wrote these words in the book of the law of God. He took a large stone and set it up under the oak that was under the sanctuary of the Lord. And Joshua said to all the people, behold, this stone shall be a witness to us, for it has heard all the words of the Lord which he spoke to us. It shall therefore be a witness to you, lest you deny God. So Joshua let the people depart, each to his own inheritance. So this scroll that Joshua rolled up, Joshua wrote, was placed beside the Ark of the Covenant. Probably on a table. It was not inside. Inside the ark were the tablets of stone, the Aaron's rod that budded, and a small jar or vase of manna. But Joshua added these promises that they made to the scroll that he had written earlier. So the result of not completing the job is given for us over in Judges chapter 1. Judges chapter 1 and verse 27 simply says, however, Manasseh did not drive out the inhabitants of Beth-Shean and its villages, or Taanach and its villages, and the inhabitants of Dor and its villages, or the inhabitants of Ibleam and its villages, or the inhabitants of Megiddo and its villages, for the Canaanites were determined to dwell in the land. And so there's a list here of the tribes that did not complete the job they were given to do. It should be a strong warning for all of us concerning the job we've been given to do. Now, in Judges chapter 2 is one of the most scary verses in the Bible that I've read. There are some verses that are very comforting, make you feel inspired, confident, full of faith. This one is more scary the older I get. Judges chapter 2 and verse 6. When Joshua had dismissed the people, the children of Israel went each to his own inheritance and to possess the land. So the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, and they who had seen the great works of the Lord which he had done. So all the elders who were the same age as Joshua, although he was, you know, obviously lived longer than most of them because he survived the 40 years of the wilderness without aging a day, he and Caleb. And it says, all the elders who outlived Joshua had seen all the great works. And Joshua the son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died when he was 110 years old. Verse 10, when all that generation had been gathered to their fathers, another generation arose after them who did not know the Lord or the work which he had done for Israel. So here we have all the people who were in the generation of Joshua and those who had known Joshua. And when they finally went the way of all flesh, a new generation came along. And the new generation forgot God. Verse 11, the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals. Verse 13, they forsook the Lord and served Baals and Asherahs, and the anger of the Lord was hot against Israel. Now, the reason that is a very concerning verse is because those who are my age, my exact age, consider ourselves the caboose. We knew Herbert Armstrong. We were not his generation, but we knew him. We had him in class for at least a few lectures. My wife and I were the last couple he ever counseled for marriage counseling, and that sort of happened by accident when he was visiting in Big Sandy. He wasn't in the process then of counseling students. But most of the men who were of Mr. Armstrong's generation are gone, and those of us who knew and were taught under his tutelage are dying off. There are fewer and fewer of us around. When I went to Ambassador College in 1972, I was one of the three youngest students to walk on campus. I was 1 week after turning 18. Scott Ashley, who just recently retired but managed the Beyond Today and other church publications for years, was 1 week younger than me. And then there was a younger guy who was only 16 years old who had scored a perfect score on the SAT at age 16, so they accepted him based on academic potential, but he didn't stay at college for very long. I think he was too smart. At any rate, we're last of the old guard. Ambassador College in Big Sandy closed after I graduated, a year after I graduated. My wife and I left, and it was reopened from time to time, but it was never the same. And so when this account here in the book of Judges sort of hits home, that the generation that knew Joshua and the generation that knew or were taught by Joshua, when they died off, the next generation did not maintain the faith. So we have a great task ahead of us. We have to make sure the next generation that we are handing the baton to does stand fast and does seek the truth and does make sure they're not letting it go and not getting intermixed with the religions of this world and the idolatry that masquerades so often as Christianity. I want to begin just the final thing here. Let's go over to Hebrews chapter 7, verse 19. What did this law of Moses accomplish? This law that we read, skip through these 16 chapters about. It was about how they were to live in the promised land, how they could have rain and dew season, protection from their enemies, a prosperous life. Now their children would be blessed. If you read the curses in Deuteronomy 28, one of the curses is that the fruit of their womb would be cursed. And we find that happening today in a terrible way, just a tragic way in the nation in which we live. One example of that, you know, the baby boom generation, of whom I'm one of the latter numbers, the rate of autism was less than 1 in 10,000 births. 1 in 10,000 births were, of young boys especially, were autistic. Got that from Robert Kennedy Jr., who is about a month older than me. The rate of autism today is 1 in 43, young boys. What has happened to our kids? Why do we have so many that are born with disabilities, so many that have challenges and can't function normally? Why do Americans take over 2 times as many prescriptions as any other nation in the earth, per capita? Not total, but per capita. Why do we take so many pills? My wife has had clients that had a coffee cup of prescriptions every morning, and some of the prescriptions were to offset the effect of their other prescriptions that caused this side effect. It's not a side effect, it's an effect. But we have a nation that is declining in health. Our national average of life expectancy has declined 3 years in the last 10. We can expect to live 3 years less. Our children, our rate of disability of our children is skyrocketing. So we are not keeping those laws, and God is withdrawing his blessings from us. But there's a larger point. The point of that law, given those chapters, that constitution of ancient Israel, a good way to describe it, was physical. It was not spiritual in nature. Look at Hebrews chapter 7 and verse 19. It says, the law made nothing perfect. Nobody was made perfect by keeping that constitution of laws. They were made healthy. They were made prosperous. They were made safe. They were not made perfect. On the other hand, there is a bringing in of a better hope through which we draw nearer to God. So we have a better hope. We have a better promises. We have better a future for us. Over in chapter 10 in verse 1, it says, "The law, having a shadow of the good things to come." Moses talked about those good things to come in the last few words of his Song of Moses that we read. "The law, having a shadow of the good things to come and not the very image of those things, can never with those sacrifices which they offer continually year by year make those who approach perfect." Now, wait a minute. I thought Jesus Christ said in Matthew 5 and verse 48, "Therefore become perfect like your Father in heaven is perfect." Go over to John chapter 17 and verse 23. So if that law that we read parts of the day in a survey form, but we read quite a bit of it, if that law could not make us perfect, could not make people perfect, how do you become perfect? John chapter 17 and verse 23, Jesus prayed, "I in them and you in me, that they may be made perfect in one, and that the world may know that you have sent me and have loved them as you have loved me." So we are made perfect in that relationship with Jesus Christ, but they didn't have that back in the time of these laws that we read today. Let's go to Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 13. Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 13. "Till we all come to the unity of the faith and the knowledge of the Son of God to a perfect man." God calls us to become a perfect man, but Hebrews is very clear that that law made no one perfect. So there has to be a better way. There has to be a different path than just those laws. He says that we should no longer be children tossed to and fro and carried about with every wind of doctrine by the trickery of men in the cunning craftiness of deceitful plotting. And of course, that's exactly what is going on around us in one of Satan's ploys. He's trying to work on God's people today. A very encouraging verse, though, is over in Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 23. Hebrews 12 and verse 23. This is, I think, one of the more encouraging sections. Chapter 11 is very encouraging about how we can obtain a good report by following the example of those who obtained a good report by living a life of faith despite all the challenges they went through. And then, of course, much in chapter 12 about enduring the discipline of God, which simply follows the same theme of chapter 11. Chapter 12 and verse 23. Let's go back to 22. "But you have come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God." See, we haven't come to Shiloh. We haven't come to the tabernacle. We haven't come to a physical temple. We have come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, and an innumerable company of angels, to the general assembly and church of the firstborn who are registered in heaven. Wonderful to know that your name is in the book of life. We're very thankful that we had an additional name written in God's book of life last evening when Susan Carr was baptized. That's when your name is written in the book of life, is when you have the Spirit of God. It's up to us to make sure we don't fall short, we don't neglect salvation, we don't fall by the wayside like the people did in the time of the judges. "So to the general assembly of the church and the firstborn who are registered in heaven, to God who is the judge of all, we come to him." We don't come to the other priest. We come to the high priest, Jesus Christ, at his right hand. Notice, "to the spirits of just men made perfect." We are able to be made perfect because of verse 24, Jesus, the mediator of the new covenant, and to the blood of sprinkling that speaks better things than that of Abel. So here we have a very wonderful promise that we can be made perfect. And that law that we read about today, that law of ancient Israel, was wonderful for national laws, and our nation should still be operating under those laws. We've rejected it, and we are paying the penalty. But the promise of eternal life and the better promises that God gave us are one of the most wonderful things taught in the Bible, because through that we have a plan where God wants each one of us to become perfect. Next time we'll go through the teachings of the Apostle Paul, what he taught about law. And then from that point, we will start our countdown on the seven changes between the Old and the New Covenant.